You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Angel Was a Centerfold by Lily Annalick. Hefner and Playboy had changed the culture, remade it in their image so that Janet Lee Redux might play a brutalized centerfold. Tippi Hedren Redux might play a nearly brutalized Triple X star. Pornographic movies were now Hollywood movies. To secure the role of Dorothy, Hemingway would agree to breast implants. She would not, however, agree to sex with Fosse. I said to him, I can't be naked every day and also then go home with you, I said. That will F me up so badly, I will probably want to kill myself. Or to sex for Fosse. Fosse thought Robert De Niro would make the perfect Snyder. De Niro, though, wouldn't even read the script. So Fosse asked Hemingway, on whom he suspected De Niro had a crush, to offer herself to the actor as an inducement. She declined. Fosse was like, "You're a pain in the ass. You're a cocktease." De Niro out. Fosse cast Eric Roberts as Snyder. Roberts was also a show business baby. His parents ran an acting school. His sister was, or soon would be, Julia Roberts, the biggest female movie star of her generation. To suggest that Star 80 is about anyone other than Dorothy would be madness. She is Star 80. Yet somehow Star 80 is about someone other than Dorothy. A pull quote from a profile of Fosse in the November 13, 1983 edition of the LA Times. Peter Bogdanovich didn't like the idea of my filming the story. He said I didn't know the true story, which was correct. But I pointed out that I was making a movie about Paul Snyder. I was making a movie about Paul Snyder. A startling enough admission, but what Fosse was really admitting was even more startling. I was making a movie about Bob Fosse. Roberts, on the moment the light bulb went off, I was having trouble with a scene and said, "Cut." "You don't say cut on a Fosse movie unless you're Fosse." He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm effing up." He goes, "God damn it, come here." I walk over to him, and I'm in my underwear, barefoot, and my skinny little legs, looking at the crew and feeling stupid. I said, "What's up?" He said, "Look at me." He got right in my face. "Look at me." I said, "I am looking at you." He said, "You're playing me if I weren't successful. Do you understand?" I got it. I just got it. I knew what he was after. Paul was the song and dance man, but with a con. From that moment on, I studied Bob's every movement, every mannerism. And if you ask me, my Paul Snyder is more Bob Fosse than Roy Scheider's Bob Fosse and all that jazz. Roberts is right. Star 80 is another version of all that jazz, is another Fosse autobiography. I think the manipulative Machiavellian side of Paul resonated with Bob because I think Bob recognized that in himself, says Hemingway. And Fosse emphasized Snyder's Fosse-like qualities, playing up Snyder's creative side. His Snyder strums the guitar, takes arty nudes, and fashions flowers out of wood. Hemingway, "Bob felt more like a Paul, obviously, than a Dorothy. I'm the less interesting character in the movie." Because Fosse made her character the less interesting character in the movie. The real Dorothy was creative, too. She was a compulsive writer of poetry. And when Snyder was cooking up ideas for Chippendales, it was Dorothy who said that they should outfit the male dancers in bow ties and cuffs. what the bunny servers wore at the Playboy clubs. She ran it past Hef, and he gave it his blessing, says Louise. The look would become world famous. Why didn't Fosse include either of these tidbits? Why portray Dorothy as a doe-eyed ding-a-ling, as not just naive, but dumb? Was he afraid smarts or toughness would jeopardize her status as blameless victim? Make people think she had it coming? Yet by denying her her smarts, by denying her her toughness, he kills all interest in her. Another kind of murder. Maybe the real question is, why was Fosse so hell-bent on identifying with Snyder in the first place? Sam Wasson, writer of Fosse, the definitive Fosse biography, says this: I think what Fosse's saying when he says, "You're me if I weren't successful," is, I too would have done anything to be a success in show business, even murder. There Fosse goes again, blabbing his dirty secrets. During filming, Fosse became fixated on getting the minutiae right, the nitty-gritty particulars. He hired as a technical advisor Sis Rundle, Hefner's social secretary. It was Rundle who took the call at the mansion about Dorothy, told Hefner. It's frozen in my mind because he was in the game room by the pinball machine, the one with his face on it, and a girl was standing next to him when I said, "It's Dorothy, she's dead." Everything got really quiet. Then this girl said, "Does that mean we're not going in the jacuzzi?" I took her arm and pulled her away. I said, "No, you're not going in the jacuzzi." Rundle made sure, for example, that when Cliff Robertson, star 80s Hefner, was walking around with a Pepsi, that Pepsi was in a bottle. Hef never drank a can of Pepsi in his life. And Fosse would sit in a screening room with a 14-year-old Louise. He wanted notes from someone in Dorothy's family. "My mom couldn't do it. It was too upsetting for her," says Louise. "So I did it. Thank God for therapy." The shoot was agony, largely because everyone knew where the story was going. Bob shot in order, says Roberts. He wanted to have death be the end, because you can't really come back and do earlier scenes after you play that and feel it. Instead, I felt everything all day, every day. I was a basket case. Fosse insisted, too, on filming at the real locations whenever he could. Every place in that movie is where it happened in reality, says Roberts. It's like a docudrama. Fosse wasn't trying to recreate the past, docudrama's goal, so much as resurrect the past. Bob had a chair on set with Dorothy's name on it, says Rundle. It's like she was there. It was like a seance. And as the dreaded bloodbath of a finale got closer and closer, he turned to Roberts and said, "He's going to do it. He's going to kill her. And I don't know how to stop him." Of course, Fosse couldn't stop Snyder, but that he imagined he could means he'd accomplished what he set out to accomplish, make the past present. In his mind, Dorothy's rape and murder wasn't fading into history, over and done with, was imminent, inevitable. And that is, I suspect, how he wanted it. He demanded that Robert spend the night with him at Dorothy and Snyder's house, the crime scene. The blood was still seeping through the ceiling, says Rundle, before those last days of shooting. The cruelest thing Fosse could have done to me, according to Roberts. And he took away, without warning, the protective belt Roberts wore for his nude scene with Hemingway. Which is why, when Wasson referred to Star 80 as a snuff movie, I nodded in surprised agreement. A snuff movie is, in a way, the ultimate Hollywood movie, because it's the Hollywood movie taken to its furthest limit, or its logical conclusion, that the peroxided glamour of a Dorothy, or of a Marilyn, was always shading into the waxy sheen of a corpse, is easy to see in retrospect. Kiss, kiss, bang, bang, indeed. Star 80 is the ultimate Hollywood movie in another sense. Hollywood's most cherished belief about itself is that it's a magical place, a place where a regular, if fabulously good-looking person might find himself or herself tapped by the wand of a fairy godmother in the guise of a casting agent or producer, transformed into a star. Getting discovered, it's called. But to get discovered is also to get exposed. Lana Turner at Schwab's Drugstore is the press release. Dorothy Stratton at the Dairy Queen is the autopsy report. Star 80 was grueling to make, grueling to watch. No one could question the integrity of Fosse's vision. The show business world he depicted was pure slime, and viewers, the few there were, dripped by the final reel. Bob Fosse's Star 80 is about the degradation of everything and everybody, wrote Pauline Kael in The New Yorker, the opening line of a pan that could just as easily have been the opening line of a rave. What made the movie loathsome was also what made it unforgettable. In Hollywood, Star 80 wasn't treated as a failure, was treated as an atrocity. To be associated with it was to be contaminated, and the effect it had on its principles was nothing short of ruinous. Fosse would be dead 4 years after its premiere. His heart attacked him, just as Joe Gideon's heart attacked Joe Gideon. Too many amphetamines. He was totally addicted, says Rundle. It killed him. And too much work. Broadway work. He never directed another movie. I think it was the end of my career, says Hemingway. An overstatement, maybe, but not a wild one. And Roberts was so good as Snyder that he was too good. Everybody decided I was that crazy mofo. I was typecast as a psychopath for years. It haunted me. Rats, spelled backward. More tellings told. More tellers ruined. In 1984... Bogdanovich published The Killing of the Unicorn, Dorothy Stratton, 1960 to 1980. In his version of the fairy tale, he's the courtly lover, Dorothy the courtly lovee, an angel in the shape of Aphrodite, Hefner the evil flesh merchant. If the shadowy Hefner side of the pyramid had never existed, Dorothy would not have died. She could have dealt with Paul Snyder, a small-town pimp, who first spotted and sold her, but she could not handle the slick professional machinery of the Playboy sex factory. The book was an act of tribute to Dorothy, but also an act of revenge on Hefner. Hefner's response was what you'd imagine. Hefner and Bogdanovich, they went to war, says Garcia. Bogdanovich indicted him with that book. Hef could not stand that, and of course he had spies out, private eyes going. He did whatever he could to pull Bogdanovich down, and he really did break Bogdanovich. He had information on Bogdanovich, and, well, Bogdanovich made poor choices, very poor choices. On April 1st, 1985, Hefner held a press conference at the mansion where he accused Bogdanovich of seducing Dorothy's mother, Nellie, breaking up Nellie's marriage, of seducing Dorothy's sister, Louise. And for the first time, when Louise was just 13, and of subjecting Louise to plastic surgery so that she might look more like his dead beloved. Colleen Camp pooh-poohs the accusations. Peter thought that because Dorothy had died tragically, he was responsible for her whole family. He had Nellie and Louise living with him in Bel Air. He was getting them French lessons, okay? I said to him, Peter, this is not a good idea. This does not look good. But he felt they needed to be taken care of, and he was oblivious as to how it looked. Peter thought he was in a Greek myth. One day he turned to me and said, I'm destined to be with Louise. I'm going to marry her when she's 18. And look, there's no possible way in a billion years that Peter was sleeping with Nellie. I know his type. And yes, he did get Louise surgery, but not a nose job or anything. It was dental surgery. Her jaw was out of alignment. A few days after Hefner's press conference, Louise filed a lawsuit against Hefner for slander, libel, and invasion of privacy. 6 months later, she dropped the suit. Around the same time, Bogdanovich issued an apology. All of us who loved Dorothy, and I know Hugh Hefner was one of these, have been through the roughest of times. He didn't have the energy to take on Hefner or the money. In 1981, Fox, the studio set to distribute They All Laughed, shelved the movie due to poor test screenings. Unable to let it languish, let Dorothy languish, he'd bought it himself, distributed it himself. He'd paid $5 million, made less than $1 million. Or even the heart. Deep down, he must have known that he was only blaming Hefner so that he didn't have to blame himself. By the end of 1985, he'd be forced to declare bankruptcy. In 1988, he'd marry Louise, 20, the same age that Shepard was when he fell in love with her, that Dorothy was when he fell in love with her. At parties, he'd say to people, "Remember me? I used to be Peter Bogdanovich." Hefner was the winner of the war, but he was the loser, too, because to achieve victory, he'd trashed the reputation of a grieving mother and a teenage girl, not a good look, as he well knew. "Just so bad taste Hollywood," he told Rolling Stone. Besides, it was time for him to lay low. Reagan was in office, Meese was forming a commission, and the moral majority was dogging his every move. At the decade's end, he'd stop being a playboy, become a married man, and his new wife, Kimberly Conrad, a playmate, what else, would persuade him to trade in his satin sheets for cotton ones, institute a no-nude swimming policy at the pool. There go the 70s, as Gary Trudeau said in his comic strip, Doonesbury. And what, finally, of Dorothy? She is the object of desire, who is the subject of all these articles and books and films, but is in the end a mystery. Not one of the portraits captures her, and that's because her portraitist, though highly skilled, are highly compromised. They are pursuing their own agendas. Teresa Carpenter to dismiss her, Hugh Hefner to commodify her, Peter Bogdanovich to idealize her, Bob Fosse to victimize her. And how can they see her clearly when they only see what they want to see? What might someone with unimpaired vision see when looking at Dorothy? Quentin Tarantino, in his podcast, The Video Archives, talks about watching footage of Dorothy taken at the Playboy Playmate of the Year ceremony held just months before she died. "We see a completely different Dorothy Stratton," he says. "One, she's completely over Snyder. She's repelled and putting up with him. What's surprising is she's over Playboy, too. You see that she has no problem with Playboy. She has no problem with Hefner. She's very grateful for everything that Playboy did to put her in the situation that it did. But she's over it." This is Stratton's exit from both Paul Snyder and Playboy itself. That speech she gives is her goodbye. That person has never been dramatized in any of these stories at all. Actually, it took my breath away to see such a strong Dorothy Stratton with such an interior life. In telling after telling, Dorothy is presented as the docile marionette of whatever man's pulling her strings at the moment. Except that reading of Dorothy doesn't square with the evidence. Dorothy always got what she needed from her men. Snyder got her out of One Horse Town, Canada, and Dairy Queen, into Bright Lights, Big City, L.A., and in front of Hefner. Hefner got her to the top of the Playboy food chain, and in front of Bogdanovich. Bogdanovich got her into a movie that bombed at the time, yet is now considered a classic. Tarantino put it sixth on his list of favorite movies for Sight and Sound, and thus got her immortality. This isn't to suggest that Dorothy was some secret femme fatale mastermind, but rather a real woman living in the real world, adjusting and adapting as necessary, that in 2 years she went from nudie cutie anonymity to the cusp of mainstream movie stardom was neither accident nor luck. One shrewd move after another is what it was. The sole mistake she made was underestimating the desperation and lunacy of Paul Snyder. A detail that could be filed under romantic could be filed under creepy. Dorothy's final resting place is the Pierce Brothers Westwood Village Memorial Park and Mortuary. Resting alongside her, Peter Bogdanovich, who died in 2022. There's no way Dorothy loved Peter the way Peter loved Dorothy, says Mickey Garcia. He was obsessed with her. Dorothy was so nice and so kind and so compassionate, so likable. But she had ambition. She wanted to break into movies. She knew he was a great director. Garcia sighs, shakes her head. Now he's buried right next to her. A detail that only could be filed under creepy. Marilyn Monroe's final resting place is also the Pierce Brothers Westwood Village Memorial Park and Mortuary. Resting alongside her, Hefner, who died in 2017. Garcia, after a heavier sigh, and we've got Hefner all cozied up to Marilyn. Marilyn didn't know Hefner, certainly didn't pose for Hefner. He bought the nudes of her from someone who wasn't her, published them in Playboy without asking her. I even had to buy a copy of the magazine to see myself in it, she said. He imposed himself on her in life, and by purchasing the crypt next to hers, he'd continue to impose himself on her in death. Hollywood won't leave these women alone. Snuff isn't enough. Necrophilia isn't enough. They're hounded into the hereafter. Only Roberts seemed to understand what had been done to Dorothy and what Dorothy was due. Fosse knew how to get a performance out of an actor, and he got it out of Eric, says Sis Rundle. I helped Eric through the whole shoot because he was so into character. He's going to be violent and threatening and scary because Paul's mind was that way. I mean, Eric was Paul. He was nuts. It was tough to be around him. But when the movie wrapped, he was so broken. He wanted to go to the cemetery where Dorothy was buried, so I took him. He laid on Dorothy's grave for almost 2 hours. He sobbed and sobbed and sobbed, sobbed like a baby. Then he took his SAG card out of his wallet and tore it up, and the wind blew the pieces all over her grave. One of the few grace notes in Dorothy's story, and the only apology Hollywood ever gave her. Rest in peace, Dorothy. Perfect Strangers. Her viral New York Times column, Was I Married to a Stranger?, devastated readers in 2023. Now, in her memoir, Strangers, Belle Burden offers a deeper personal history, from a glimpse of her childhood at her grandmother Babe Paley's estate, Killuna Farm, through the unraveling of a marriage that reshaped her understanding of family. Photographs by Adriana Gleviano. Opening photograph, Belle Burden, photographed at home in New York City on November 14th. James landed on Martha's Vineyard just before 2 p.m. He drove down our driveway in a Jeep our caretaker had left for him at the airport, a model similar to the one he'd driven onto the ferry a month earlier. He walked up the brick path to our door. He wore a mask, so I couldn't see his whole face, but my first thought was that he seemed happy, his step brisk and optimistic. He was carrying an empty duffel bag over his shoulder. He said he had only 90 minutes until he had to return to the airport. We gathered in the living room, on the side we rarely used, where two white couches flanked a large coffee table. I sat between the girls on one of the couches, my arms around both of their small shoulders. James paced back and forth in front of us, still masked, the glass doors of our living room and the expanse of the lake behind him. He said, Mom and I are separated and we're going to divorce. I haven't been happy. He continued to pace while he spoke, not looking at either of the girls, not looking at me. I watched him, thinking, the way he is moving and talking is so different. I don't recognize his body, his voice. Is he having a breakdown? Is he in love? Is he just delighted to be free of me, of us? As soon as he said the word divorce, Carrie twisted her body to face the back of the couch. She was smiling. She thought he was joking. Then she looked at me, saw my grave expression, and shrieked. I tried to grab her, but she fled down the stairs, wailing in agony. Evie sat still and silent, with her arms crossed. James turned to me and said, I'm starving. Can you make me a sandwich? I stared back at him, shocked. I didn't know what to say in front of Evie. I tried to reason out an answer. Wouldn't a good mother make their child's father a sandwich? Wasn't this how the world said you were supposed to behave in a divorce? Be nice to each other in front of the kids? I said, okay, but please go find Carrie. I went to the kitchen. With my hands shaking, I toasted slices of sourdough bread, spread mustard, layered turkey, sliced avocado and tomato, sprinkled sea salt. I thought, if I'm doing this, I'm going to do it well. I will not make a shitty sandwich. Maybe part of me thought that it would make him regret what he was doing. How could he leave a wife who made such good sandwiches? I thought this, even though in that moment I didn't want him, this version of him, to stay. I put the sandwich on a white plate with a bamboo rim and sliced it in half. I looked at our collection of cotton napkins and selected one in a blue-flowered print. I roamed the house looking for him, carrying the plate and the napkin. He wasn't with either girl. Carrie was in the guest room, curled on the couch. Evie was in her bed, the covers pulled up, looking at her phone. Evie told me later that before she'd gone to her room, James had taken her out to the lawn with one of his slingshots, explaining that it was now her job to keep the geese away. He showed her how to insert the pellet, pull back the sling, aim, and shoot. I finally found him in the basement. He had several cardboard boxes at his feet. He was squatting in front of them, rummaging through the contents, papers and folders and notebooks. I watched as he pulled down two more boxes. He was sweating with the effort. I asked him what he was doing. He turned to me with the same cold green eyes I'd seen the day he left. He said, I'm looking for our prenup. If you have it, you have to give it to me. The prenup was missing. My lawyer from 1999 had died, and his firm had no record of the document. James couldn't reach his lawyer, now retired, and neither of us had a signed copy in our email. I stood there, at the top of the basement stairs, holding the plate, watching him. I told him to stop, to be with the girls during his remaining minutes in the house, but he continued, pulling box after box off the shelves. His duffel sat open on the floor beside the boxes, ready to receive what he found. He finally gave up his search. When it was time to go back to the airport, he ate the sandwich quickly as he stood by the front door. I told the girls to come say goodbye. They leaned against the banister, staring at him. He said, "The Ospreys are back." I nodded, "Yes, we've seen them." When he walked to the borrowed Jeep, the girls and I got in our Toyota, a big family car, to pick up Chinese takeout from one of the only restaurants open on the island. I wanted to leave first, before James. I didn't want my daughters to see their father drive away, his car disappearing over the hill. I feared the image would stay in their minds forever. I should have known it was the image of him pacing in his mask, not looking at them as he delivered the awful news that would stick. Next photo, Island Time. Babe Paley, Burden's grandmother, photographed poolside at Round Hill, her villa in Jamaica, by Slim Aarons in 1959. The girls and I ate together at the kitchen table, watching Gilmore Girls as we did each night. We'd seen every episode multiple times, and the familiarity was soothing. My phone pinged. It was a text from James. "That was a great visit." I stared at the sentence, stunned. He had rewritten the wrenching scenes we'd just lived, making them something different, something happy. I didn't write back. A few weeks later, he sent an email with no message, only an attachment. It was a scan of the prenup. His lawyer had located it in a storage facility. When I opened the document and scrolled to the last page, I stopped at the sight of my own name. My signature looked innocent and hopeful, in blue ink and careful script, dated 5 days before our wedding. In the evenings, after the sunset, once I cleaned up dinner and the girls disappeared to their rooms, I had another expanse of time to fill. If I got in bed before 10 p.m., the night was unbearably long. I continued to rely on jigsaw puzzles, returning to the card table in the living room with a cup of tea, always in the same seat, methodically putting the pieces into place until the clock showed me some mercy, turning to the hour when I could end the day. As I sat working, I often felt the presence of several of my deads, as my stepmother, Susan, called them. My grandmother, my father, and childhood friend, Lynn, all sitting at the table with me. My grandmother, Babe, was to my left, my father across from me, and Lynn to my right. The feeling was strange. I have never believed in ghosts, but their presence was comforting. It felt like they were standing guard, protecting me. Next to me, my grandmother's presence was warm, caretaking. Despite, or maybe because of, her failings as a mother, she had been a wonderful grandmother. She loved having me, my brother, and my older cousins at Kiluna Farm. She let us run wild, delighting in our presence, giving us her rapt attention. She insisted we join the adults at cocktails in the library, lunches in her garden, dinners in the dining room. To entertain us, she would arrange a large piece of lettuce or spinach in her teeth, smiling, pretending it wasn't there. We would dissolve into laughter, squealing, "Baba," the name we called her, the name my children call my mother now. She cheered when my older cousin directed us in elaborate skits performed for her guest after dinner. She was tactile and affectionate. She always pulled me onto her lap, kissed the nape of my neck, and told me what flavor she tasted, honey, marmalade, lavender. We played patty cake and backgammon. At bedtime, she used her long red manicured nails to compose imaginary paintings on my face. She let me try on her jewelry, the two of us in front of her mirror, her graceful hands clasping necklaces around my neck, bracelets on my small wrist. She had fake versions of my favorite pieces made for me for Christmas, all perfectly arranged in a red lacquer box. My grandmother was and is famous for her beauty and style. She was widely photographed, first as a model, then as a young woman in New York, then as a wife, first to my grandfather, Stanley Mortimer, then to Bill Paley. Images of her have become iconic. Her face in profile by Richard Avedon, a Horst portrait of her wearing a color block dress, her wrist wrapped in pearls, a series by Slim Aarons at her house in Jamaica, casual in pants and a straw hat. She was meticulous in crafting her image and how she presented herself to the world. Her clothing, her hair and makeup, her jewelry, her homes, how she entertained. She cared about every detail. But her style was also natural, instinctual. It came easily. She set trends by the simplest action, like famously tying her scarf to the handle of her pocketbook. She was first named to the International Best Dressed List in 1941, and photographs of her are still printed, posted, and exchanged 80 years later, as new generations adopt her as a fashion icon. But my grandmother was more than her famous image. She was brilliant, able to lead a conversation on any topic. She was funny, she read constantly, she was rarely at rest. She was an artist, drawing in pencil and sculpting in clay, skills she kept hidden from most of the world. Her father, Harvey Cushing, was a brain surgeon, and I think she inherited her intellect from him, along with her long, elegant hands. Her style was born from the same things, intelligence and artistry. In a more modern era, she might have claimed her talents publicly as an editor, a designer, an artist. But she was raised to be a wife, to support her husband, to be the perfect hostess, not to forge an identity apart from those tasks. Within these restrictions, she expressed herself in surfaces. She died of lung cancer in 1978, the day after her 63rd birthday, when I was 9. I had not thought of her often in my adult life, usually only if I saw a photograph of her on Instagram or when my brother and I reminisced about our time at Kaluna Farm. But she was very present in the days, weeks, and months after James left. I often woke up thinking about her, as though she'd been whispering in my ear as I slept. There were and are persistent rumors that Bill Paley was a philanderer, rumors fictionalized and retold in print and on television, like a game of telephone, the facts becoming murkier in each retelling. The rumors are now tied closely with the writer Truman Capote, who was, for a time, my grandmother's close friend and confidant. In 1975, he published a chapter of his unfinished novel in Esquire, in which a man closely resembling Bill has an affair with a governor's wife. My grandmother was devastated by the publication of the story, presumably because Capote had betrayed her trust and her privacy, which she guarded fiercely, and co-opted her life for his own purposes. She never spoke to Capote again. While my mother knew nothing of her stepfather's affairs, she grew to accept that he was unfaithful. It was a common phenomenon among rich and powerful men of the era, part of the package. My mother loved him anyway, as did I. We saw him often in the years after my grandmother's death, at his house at Lyford Cay in the Bahamas, or in his apartment on Fifth Avenue. He often expressed deep grief over losing my grandmother and regret for not appreciating her enough. My mother also had a pattern of loving unfaithful men, including both of her husbands and her beau of 3 decades, a journalist. She broke up with the journalist several times because of his infidelity, for the final time in 2018. Next photos, family matters, burden with Babe Paley at Kaluna Farm in 1973, with Bill Paley in 1975, Burden's family at Lake Tashmu in 2009, with her son in 2002, with her father, Carter, in 1973, with her mother, Amanda Burden, at the farm. And this article is from the book Strangers, A Memoir of Marriage by Bell Burden. Copyright 2026, Bell Burden. Published by the Dial Press, an imprint of Random House, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved. Without being conscious of it, as a child and a young adult, I absorbed this legacy of infidelity. I heard my grandfather described as naughty, my mother's boyfriend as a flirt, the betrayals chalked up to unavoidable temptation, a natural accessory to success. I saw that my grandmother and mother had forgiven these men, that they'd quietly cleaned up the mess, never saying a word about it. I felt in my bones an acceptance of men behaving badly, a value in not calling them out, in protecting a man's belief in his own importance, and a premium placed on keeping such things private. I thought I had ended this legacy by marrying someone so steady, so unassuming, someone who didn't have a public presence, someone who didn't flirt with other women, at least not in front of me. But I had repeated it in a spectacular fashion. Unlike my grandfather and my mother's boyfriend, James seemed to have no regret, and he didn't want me back. The similarity was that he felt entitled to do it, and he expected me to stay quiet about it. In the living room each night, as I worked on my puzzle, with my grandmother's ghost sitting calmly beside me, I'd wonder, what is it about the women in my family that attracts this kind of betrayal? Will the same thing happen to my girls? Did James have his own legacy of men behaving badly, walking out without an explanation, of women stoically enduring it? Did we both have another legacy of adults remaining silent, never explaining what had happened, pushing it underground into the subconscious lives of the next generations, creating a destiny where the bad thing could be and would be repeated? Lynn, sitting to my right at the card table, looked as she did before she became sick, beautiful with dark curly hair, a spark in her blue eyes. She could be very blunt and told me once early in my marriage that she didn't understand James. She couldn't connect with him, which I took to mean that she didn't like him. I was defensive, but I ask myself now, had she identified something I didn't want to see? A coldness? An unknowability? Now in my distress, she wasn't gloating. She seemed to be reminding me of what we'd discussed many times. Everyone has something. This is yours. Each life has a defining crisis. This was, of course, an easy one, relative to many, relative to hers. My father's presence across from me was intense. He was upset. It felt like he was saying, I trusted him too. I trusted him with you. As James moved deeper into the investment world, I handed more of our financial life over to him. He understood the stock market, balance sheets, taxes. He could have the conversations with bankers and lawyers that I hated. Bankers and lawyers had always been tied up in my mind with the turmoil of my father's death. He told me how much money to wire into our checking account every month, the amount to pay in taxes. He dealt with the gas company, the landscaper, the accountants, the bookkeeper, anything and everything to do with money. James was protective of me financially, always speaking up for my interests with my family. He also kept a sharp eye on our spending. Our transfers into our checking account, always equal, were small numbers. We were often in overdraft after I paid our regular bills, requiring another transfer. James preferred this scenario because he thought it made us more aware of our spending, what he called our burn rate. He became agitated if our joint visa bill was too high, a vacation too expensive. At hotels, he made me smuggle food to him from the breakfast buffet. Hard-boiled eggs in paper coffee cups, a muffin in my pocket, so that we didn't have to pay one more cover. He asked me to annotate our joint credit card bills, explaining each charge in tiny print. Because of his anxiety, his watchfulness, I hid some things, the kids' clothes, their birthday and Christmas presents, my clothes, paying for them on my own credit card, the Amex I paid myself, the one we didn't split, the one I didn't have to show him. My family paid other expenses for us, including school tuition and college savings plans for each child. It felt like another offering to James, taking these weighty costs off his shoulders. He had excessive moments, too, usually when it related to his passions. With his salary, he could finally afford to buy the things he loved, and he didn't hold back. A dozen rare Rolex watches, several motorcycles, rare coins, custom suits, a small vintage boat that had been used in Live and Let Die, and expensive red wine, hundreds of bottles that we added to the ones I had inherited from my father, storing all of them in a climate-controlled facility in New Jersey. We acquired other things together, Berenice Abbott photographs of downtown Manhattan I gave James on his birthday, pets, a gecko, multiple fish, a golden doodle, piles of our children's artwork, books, Amex points, the stuff you accumulate when you're married, have kids, and have money. Our apartment, though still modern and minimalist, was filled with all of it, layer upon layer of life, of comfort, and security. I paid our bills online and signed our tax returns, but slowly I lost touch with both the big picture and the details of our financial life, depending on James to tell me what to do. I felt some shame about it, about not being involved, about not asking questions. But I was afraid I wouldn't understand it, that it was too complicated for me, even though I was a former corporate lawyer. I settled into the vagueness, the luxury and privilege of not knowing. And part of me liked it, the handing over. James's care for our money felt like his contribution to our family, the way he showed his love and commitment to me and the kids. There was something romantic about it, too, the smart and honorable man, the devoted husband and father, shouldering this part of our life. I had my own bucket of responsibility, the kids, their school, the meals, the homework, the bedtimes, so it made sense that he would take on our finances. We were dividing and conquering. In the first weeks after James left, I parked my worry about what would happen to me financially in a corner of my mind. He said we would continue the status quo, meaning our regular system of funding our accounts, paying bills. He had contributed his standard amount to our checking account on April 1st. I thought, at least I don't have to worry about this. He will not abandon me financially. But the signed prenup glowed like a burning ember in my inbox. Before James's lawyer found it in document storage, I had started to believe it was lost. I thought, maybe we never signed it. Or maybe we signed it, but failed to deliver it back to our lawyers and lost it in the move to Broadway. Or in my new mystical moments, maybe my father had somehow from beyond the grave gotten rid of it. The prenup would entitle James to an equal share of everything we had put in a joint name, including the house and the apartment. It would allow him to keep everything he earned during the marriage and kept in his own name, a number I did not yet know. This was the change we had made to the prenup in the days before we got married, the change James had requested. When I found James searching the basement, I knew he wouldn't find the prenup. I had already opened every box, both the ones on the shelves and a bigger set in the crawl space, boxes marked with James's initials, sealed shut with packing tape. I used a box cutter to open each one and pulled out piles of papers, going through every page as I sat cross-legged on the cold concrete floor, the space lit by a single hanging light bulb. I placed the papers back in their folders, back in the boxes, carefully, neatly, and resealed them with tape so he wouldn't know I'd opened them. After 6 hours, I came out of the basement covered in dirt, dust, and sweat. I didn't find it. If I had, I would have burned it. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Or you can just ask your smart speaker to play North Carolina Reading Service. If you have questions or comments, you can reach us at 919-832-5138. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.